Pacific Lutheran University. This is, I just finished my second year there. And prior to that, I taught at a community college downtown Boston and also for the University of Massachusetts at the Lowell location. And I typically teach introductory philosophy courses and introductory ethics, but my specialty area is Søren Kierkegaard, and I wrote my dissertation on the role of silence within his ethics. Typically, silence is seen as a way of being secretive or concealing and a form of lying, but Kierkegaard thinks it has a specific positive moral role in terms of humbling ourselves and also lifting up the neighbor. So that's what I wrote about in my dissertation, and it's been a real treat to be at PLU because they've wanted me to teach on Kierkegaard. So I've taught my first existentialism courses and Kierkegaard classes while I've been there. So it's been really wonderful. So I just wanted to start out talking about a little bit of historical background, and then I'll talk about philosophy briefly and about Socrates briefly, and then we'll look at the text itself, and then we'll talk about how the text is related to different branches of philosophy and what it could possibly mean in terms of education. So I want to start 43 years ago. I was listening to an audio archive of Howard Hahn, who spoke here during the summer, and he did a series very similar to this one. He was talking about literary forms and also Søren Kierkegaard's book, Sickness Unto Death. And Howard was a very important mentor in my life and is one of the reasons why I studied Kierkegaard as a graduate student and why I'm doing my job now. And he was a very dear friend of Carol Hinderle, who was the director of Holden Village from, I think it was 63 to 78. It was wonderful to listen to Howard's voice on the audio archive, so it's a really great little thing that you were doing with that. Howard often described philosophy as a way of getting at the root of things. Typically, when people think of philosophy, they think of something that's way up here in the clouds, that's very esoteric, that's detached from our ordinary practical life. And when students take philosophy courses and get enamored with the subject and all of a sudden want to major in it, their parents freak out and think, what are you going to do with that? But I think it's because students get a sense that it is really embedded into the kind of core, into the center of their life, and it helps them be able to think about things in a different way than they ever considered. I think of philosophy as something that we do very easily as children, and then it gets pounded out of us, that kind of curiosity and that inquisitiveness. And so Howard talked about it as getting at the root of things. So what is philosophy? There's a lot of different understandings of the subject itself. It literally means love of wisdom. And so in my classes, we distinguish wisdom from knowledge. So knowledge as the acquisition of facts, but wisdom, knowing when those facts should be applied. And it also relates to different qualities of character and maturation in terms of knowing and character judgment and knowing when to say and do things. And so for Socrates, who we look at to as being the archetype philosopher, in fact, all the philosophers who came before him are called the pre-Socratics. They were a wonderful group, but they're all grouped together in one kind of big blob as those who came before Socrates, because Socrates is seen as the archetype. So today we're going to be looking at this passage from Plato's Republic. Socrates never wrote anything himself, at least that we know of, and we know about him from four main sources. So we know about him from Aristophanes, who wrote a play called The Clouds. He describes Socrates as a sophist, as a professional money-seeking philosopher. In Plato's work, however, Socrates is always distinguished from the sophist. He's seen as somebody who lives off of the kindness of his friends, who's not interested in selling his wares as a philosopher, but rather is really interested soul-mindedly in the pursuit of truth. We also know about him from fragments of Xenophon's histories and then also from little pieces of Aristotle's work. So the lineage goes from Socrates, who, and then Plato was Socrates' student, and then Aristotle was Plato's student. So we think of those being the three major figures of classical philosophy. So this text that you have here is Plato's Republic. This was written quite late in Plato's life, and Socrates is a character in this text, and we're going to be reading this segment that talks about what he says education is like, and it's a very interesting passage because it's describing people as prisoners in the cave, and he says specifically they're like us. So it's not simply ignorant people, but it's everybody, Socrates included. So we have what we call, first of all, the problem of Socrates, that we don't really know who he is because we know about him from these four sources. And we know that Plato had a really huge political agenda in painting him as a certain kind of person. Because Socrates was sentenced to death, Plato was an outspoken critic of the democracy in Athens, and so he wanted to portray Socrates as some kind of political hero who was critical of the Athenian democracy. So the problem with Socrates is that we don't know who he is. We have this heroic portrait that's painted for us by Plato. And so when we talk about Socrates, usually we're talking about that figure, but he might be imaginary for all we know. I mean, we know that he was a historical figure, but we don't know if it's the same one that Plato is describing in his works and his dialogues, particularly. So we see before in the Republic, we see Socrates appear in a series of dialogues where he goes out into the Agora and he talks with various people about different questions. What is virtue? What is friendship? Can virtue be taught? What is the correct form of government? How do a philosopher and a sophist and a statesman differ? What is the correctness of names? Should Socrates avoid his execution? So these were the kinds of questions that he was discussing with various people that he came across in the Agora, which was the Athenian marketplace. We also talk about two other things that are important to know for background information. The first is the Socratic method, so you may have heard that before. This is often used as a kind of a catchphrase for different kinds of pedagogy and is often used in law schools. But in the dialogues particularly, what is taking place with the Socratic method is that Socrates begins with a question. For example, in the Meno, he asks, can we teach virtue? And so the person that he's talking with says, well, yeah, of course it can be taught. And Socrates says, well, wait a second, what do we mean by virtue? And then the person that he's talking with realizes he doesn't even have a definition of virtue, so how could he answer the question of whether it could be taught if he doesn't even know what it is that they're asking about in the first place? So the Socratic method is a way of revealing and identifying assumptions that are hidden, then clearing them away or dismantling them, and then starting from scratch. And it's often not about the end result, but it's really about the process of inquiry, about kind of, sometimes we call it the slash and burn method, right? So somebody comes and they think that they know something, and Socrates attacks them from all these angles and then ends up having it just totally burnt to the ground. And so some philosophers, like Kierkegaard, for example, ask if this is really a legitimate method of learning or if it's just a form of humiliation, because often the people that Socrates is discussing with feel humiliated, and some of them get really upset with him, like Thrasymachus in the Republic, jumps in, and he's described like a wild animal trying to attack Socrates. So we have the problem of Socrates, we have the Socratic method, and then the third thing that's important for background information is what we call Socratic ignorance. So there was a guy named Chaerephon who went to the Oracle of Delphi, who's this figure that sits at the top of the mountain, the one that you always imagine when you hear the term philosopher, right, the person sitting at the top, who basically is a prophet, can tell the future, can see the truth in a clearer way than other people. My colleague who teaches Greek next door to me at PLU takes students to Delphi quite often, and he says that there's actually some kind of natural spring or natural gases underneath this mountain. So they think that this figure actually may have been high from the chemicals that were being produced by the geological something. And so, but people would often climb up this mountain and ask the oracle questions, and so Chaerephon asked, who is the wisest? And the oracle said, Socrates. So Chaerephon scrambled back down the mountain and said, hey, Socrates, guess what? The oracle says you are the wisest. And Socrates, rather than being flattered, was quite floored and surprised, and he didn't think it was possible, so he started going around testing people. So he would go up to somebody and say, well, I've heard this, that I'm the wisest, and so I want to test myself against you. and see if it really is the case. Well, you can imagine that this didn't make him a very popular figure. And so some people think that this is one of the reasons why people were so eager to execute him in Athens, because he had really irritated so many. But he came to the end of this kind of question period of all the different people, the craftspeople, the statesmen, the rhetoricians, the poets, the musicians. He asked all of them, and he came to the conclusion, actually, yeah, I am the wisest, but it's not for the reason you think. It's not because he knew more. It's because he recognized the limits of his own knowledge. Right? So he says, whereas other people think that they know something, I know what I know versus what I don't know, because people often think that they know more than they actually do. He says, none of us know anything that's worth knowing, but I do know where my knowledge stops. So Socratic ignorance is equivalent to Socratic wisdom. Right? So it's this kind of ironic twist that his wisdom consisted in his acknowledgement of ignorance. So another good understanding of philosophy is really about the humbling of reason. What are the limits of what we can know versus what it is that we can say for certain? And for philosophers, that's really one of the central questions. What can we know? How do we know it? So those three things are really important. The problem of Socrates, Socratic method, and Socratic ignorance, and those kinds of things will help us as we read this text to think about what it is that Socrates is saying here about education. So I think you guys didn't get a text. Okay, does anybody else need one? Because I have an extra one. So this passage that I gave you is only 2.5 pages long, and I think rather than reading it aloud, I think it's good always at the end of the day to have some a period of time that's quiet, where you read a text slowly and carefully. I'm often teaching my students in college classes to do the opposite of what they learned in high school, to read slowly, to read multiple times, and to savor it. They've been taught in high school to absorb and read as fast as they can. Right, get the, you know, thesis sentence and then keep moving on and be able to pick out facts. But there's something really important about the slowing down process of reading, because if philosophy is thinking in slow motion, if you do something in slow motion, all of a sudden alternatives become possible where you hadn't seen any before, right? Because we get into rhythms and routines, and so we get kind of locked into a certain way of doing things. So reading slowly and carefully is a good thing. So I'll give you a few minutes to look at this text, and then we'll discuss it.
Starting at book 7?
Yep, starting at book 7, and then there's that page and a half, and then there's on the back just that one place where I put that little bracket at the bottom of the page. Okay. All right, so when I have students look at this text, we talk about three different layers of reading. The first one is just simply what is being said, or what is the literal meaning of the text. So what is the story? What is the scene? So we can think about it that way first. Then we look at what it means. What is this an allegory for? An allegory is an extended metaphor. So we want to know what these various symbols represent. What is Socrates trying to show us in the story? And then the last level of reading is the evaluative piece. Is he right? Was this worth saying? So oftentimes when students are faced with a difficult text or something that they don't understand, they're eager to jump to the evaluative piece. I don't like it because it's hard or it's weird or just. So when we go through those different pieces, right, and then leave the evaluation for the end, then it gives them a chance to actually grasp what it is that's being said. So we want to figure out what it is that Socrates is talking about here, and he tells us right away in the first sentence what this is. So this is education. This is a story about education. And it takes place where? Where do they start?
In a cave.
In a cave, and they're prisoners. Right? And so here at the top of 1133, they're like us, right? So he's talking with Chaerephon, or with Glaucon, excuse me, and he says, Glaucon says, this is a strange image you're describing, these prisoners that are chained in this cave. And Socrates says, they're like us. So it's not as if these are the ignorance of the world, separate from us. these are us, this is our human condition, this is who we are. And so we are to imagine a particular scene. This cave is down below. There is an entrance that goes out to the light. So you imagine in the back of the cave, there is some kind of egress that is a rocky, steep path that goes out. Right? So that's in the back of the cave. And then in the center of the cave are these prisoners that are all chained, and we're to imagine them bound with both of their feet and also their necks. So they can't move their heads, right? And they're looking straight ahead at a wall. And behind them is a bridge. And behind that bridge is a fire. So there is a source of light that is natural light that's coming from outside the cave. But then there is another source of light, namely the fire, that is behind them. There are things that are being transported across the bridge behind them, and then the fire that's behind them is casting shadows onto the wall in front of them. And so when they see somebody traveling with jugs or with animals or puppets or something like this across the bridge behind them, they look on the wall and they see the shadows of those things that are illuminated for them. And they give those things names, and that's all they see. So this is the setting that we're given at the very beginning. And Socrates is saying, this is us, right? We are taking false things, or we're taking shadows, to be true things. So then all of a sudden we're supposed to imagine that this prisoner is suddenly released. Now, he doesn't do this by himself, because he wouldn't know to do this by himself. Somebody's doing this for him. And we don't know who this is, and this is one of the most difficult parts of this story, is he's forcibly dragged out of the cave. And we're, who is this person that's dragging him out of the cave? But this figure is always shadowy. We don't know who this is. So all of a sudden, the first stage is all of a sudden the prisoner's neck is released. And so all of a sudden can look around and see fellow prisoners that are in a similar situation, can see the bridge behind, can see the fire, and can see maybe the exit in the back. And so that's all they can see. Then their feet are loosened, and then somebody, this hand, whatever, drags them up out of the cave. And what's really interesting about the language that's used to describe this exit is very violent, right? Forcibly dragged out. He doesn't want to do this. It's steep. It's described as rocky. It's constantly described as painful, blinding, right? And he keeps saying that if he was left to his own devices, he would flee back to what was familiar to him. So then finally he comes outside, and he's in the sun, and he sees the true things. Now it would be nice if it stayed there, but it doesn't at all, because the prisoner then returns to the cave, and so we can talk about whether or not the prisoner is morally obligated to return to inform the fellow prisoners about what he's seen or not. It seems like he is, according to Socrates. But what happens when the prisoner returns? What do the other prisoners say?
He lost his sharpness of vision. He's no good in this world anymore.
Yes. And he kind of isn't, because his eyes have gotten used to the sun, and so he comes down to this dim place, and so he really can't see very well. But they mock him, they ridicule him, they say they can't see things for what they really are. And then ultimately they do what? If they could. Kill him, right? So this is often a really shocking story about education. I mean, education should be like-minded fellow travelers sitting around a fire, right, thinking about interesting things. But Socrates has something else in mind, something that's scary and terrifying and dangerous, and ultimately something that will cost you your life if you're doing it the right way, or somebody does it to you the right way, or because we never know how this actually takes place, this loosening of chains. So there's an interesting aspect to all of this, that this has really become the Western story of what education is, in some sense. That it is somehow external to us, that it requires struggle and effort and suffering, and we kind of don't know where we'll end up at the end. It could be very dangerous, potentially dangerous for us. So we can think of, when we're reading this, what it could possibly mean in terms of figures, that historical figures that we could think that maybe saw something different than what everybody else sees, and then had to suffer and die for it. I mean, lots of examples spring to my mind, and I hope they come to your mind as well. But this is a very Western version of what truth is. I have a colleague who teaches Taoism come in and say, this idea of truth being external to us or outside of us is a very foreign idea to Taoism, because in Taoism, it's already in us, we just have to reveal it, right? We just have to realize that it's already there, that it's not something that we have to scramble after or suffer for, but that actually we have some kind of joyful interplay with ourselves and recognition that it's already present. So this is a Western, this is kind of a canonical text for a Western version of what education really is. And so we can, if you wish, we can talk about whether or not we think that this is accurate, but let's continue on with the allegory itself. So we can think about what the two forms of light represent, the fire versus the sun. We already have discussed who the prisoner represents, because Socrates clearly says it's all of us, Socrates included. And then we can also think about what this experience is like for the prisoner, and who this hand could possibly belong to that is doing the releasing of this prisoner. So I wonder if you have any thoughts about the fire, about the sun, about who it is that is forcing this education.
In a general sense, the evolutionary thrust of nature tends to get more complex and sophisticated over time, some people say that. So maybe it's just the evolutionary push that we're subjected to, whether we like it or not, you know, that the sun and light is the force of illumination. Kind of, once we become language-bearing sentient beings, we're on this push, you know, and it's something seems to be evolving us.
Yes, now this is interesting, because one of the central questions of philosophy has always been, what is so unique about human beings? Is it our ability to reflect? Is it our ability to reflect on our mortality? Is it our ability to use reason, to use language, right? And all these sorts of things. So whereas we could just take the shadows as being the truth, we can actually apply some kind of questioning, well, is there something else other than that? Even if that's all I see, maybe I have some kind of curiosity. Could there be something else? Is there something that's making these shadows? And there's a classic problem that was posed in the 1980s by a Harvard professor named Hilary Putnam. Are we all brains in a vat? Could it be possible that we're not really sitting here, but there is some kind of ultimate manipulator who has taken us hostage and is feeding our brain, or whatever our reasoning organ is, to make us think that we're having this experience, but we're actually not. So you can think of, right, the Matrix, and there's lots of sci-fi movies that have that same kind of thing. But what if reality is totally different from what it is that we're experiencing? How do we know that this is true, or that this is really happening? And so we see this kind of questioning already taking place within the cave.
And so, we'd be terrified if somebody dragged us out of this particular existence and showed us.
Yes.
We would be terrified.
And so we see that already in the prisoner, and also in the prisoners that he returns to, this defensiveness. How dare you question my reality? Because it's so scary. If we aren't really here, and we are really just being...
And if I came back from that place, you'd think I was crazy.
Oh, totally.
And you want to lock me up.
Yes.
I'm dangerous now.
Exactly. Exactly. Right, because you questioned the entire system.
So does the fire then represent humans, their pre-existent knowledge and security, versus the sun being, what is the interplay then between?
Yes, so it's often, the interpretation often is that the sun is truth with a capital T, right? This is the ultimate reality, and that there's something artificial or man-made about the fire itself, that it's somehow some kind of human artifact or some kind of human production as part of this shadow play that's being put forward. So one of the interesting questions is, who is doing the dragging out of the cave? But another interesting question is, who is putting on the shadow play? because that's also very manipulative, and so we can, this ends up creating all these kinds of things about paranoia. Well, what's true, and how can I distinguish what's true?
And who's feeding the fire?
How do you know what so if the sunlight itself that you, or you, what you think is the sunlight isn't really the sunlight?
Exactly, and how do we know that there are multiple layers, right? So we drag out of this cave into another cave, and then go into another cave.
So now you
so how would you ultimately know? And so these are serious philosophical questions. How can we know these things?
But there's no answer.
Well, this is an interesting question because I think there has to be, right? I think it's a different kind of thing to ask whether we can know it, right, than to ask whether or not there is a truth. And so that's often been kind of the struggle that philosophy has faced, and why a lot of people criticize it for not being valuable. Because if we can't decide, or if we can't conclude that we're not brains in a vat, right, or that we don't know for certain that this is a real experience, then everything is up for grabs, and it's just a matter of opinion, right? What is it that I'm going to cling to in a stronger sense than somebody else who might be more open to it being something else? And I think that that's always been the problem that philosophy has faced, and that's why I think parents of my students are always so nervous about them doing it. Because they say it's just about opinions, and it's about whoever's most persuasive with their language, right? You can get the most
followers.
But
isn't that the way we operate?
Yeah.
In our current society.
Yes, right? And so this is there's a radical nature to this allegory. Specifically, politically radical. Because one of the most interesting questions we can ask as a consequence of this story is, if we are living in a society where there are people who have different or competing versions of what is true, we have prisoners, we have people maybe on their way out of the cave, people who've been out of the cave already and come back, how can we all get along if we have competing ideas of what is real and what is true? And I think this is kind of one of the ultimate questions about how do we have a society in which we have competing versions of what is true and what is real. And this is the whole story of the Republic to begin with, because the question is, what is justice? And so it leads us to these questions about how we are to live, who is to govern, right? If people have different views of what's true, who gets to say what people should believe or how people should be educated?
It used to be that we were more homogeneous and we thought alike, and now every person has their own experience, their own truth.
Yes.
Every group, every plan.
Right.
Every church.
Right. And I think, you know, in philosophy, one of the things that I find myself constantly pushing against with in my students is this idea of relativism. So cultural relativism, for example, that we see lots of different practices all over the world, right? In some cultures, it's okay to eat dogs. In some cultures, it's okay to have multiple spouses, right? In some cultures, it's okay for people to practice infanticide. So we have all of these different practices, and a lot of students are aware that it's important to be tolerant and open-minded. Say, I can't imagine practicing infanticide in this society, but Inuit culture lives in a totally different kind of environment, and they recognize that they have to protect the group that's already alive, and that this is maybe their only option to protect the people who are living given limited resources. And so it makes sense, right? The more that we dig back, we can say, well, it might make sense for them to do some kind of practice that's so different from ours. And then when we see all of these practices, now my students say, well, then we can't possibly judge. We can't possibly say what's better versus, right, the society with infanticide or one that's with it. We can't make any value distinctions between them, right? But I think we have to, because I think if we have a notion of moral progress, I think it's better that we live in a society in which women can vote, for example. Then I believe that there is progress. So when I say that there's progress, I'm saying that there's something that's better than something else. And I think we have to do that to be able to make some kind of progress. One which they can't vote is different, obviously, than one in which they can vote. But I think it's better to be in one where they can vote. And so I have to make that value judgment. If I want to have a notion of progress or striving or moving toward something. But to say that we have the ultimate truth, that's a kind of a different kind of thing. And I don't think that we have to do that while we're still resisting relativism. Yeah. But the question of, is there a truth? I think I'd have to say yes. Can we know what it is? I don't know. What about that one? Right?
So,
that's a different kind of question.
So the test for truth is it beneficial, right?
Well, there's lots of different views about what truth can be, right? So there's various theories. One would be something is true if, in fact, it corresponds with reality. This is made out of rock. If, in fact, it is made out of rock, and I could somehow test it in a laboratory and say rock is made up of these particular kinds of molecules. Right? Now, some philosophers say, well, all I know are my own ideas. I can't see rock separate from my experience of it, so I can never get to the bottom of what this is, right? Strip this thing of all of its properties that I'm experiencing, I can't say anything more about it. Okay? So there are other different theories of truth, like coherence theories of truth, that say I have my system of belief, and as long as all of them are consistent, logically consistent with them, then that's the one that I'm going to work with. If I find that there's some kind of logical inconsistency between my beliefs, then I have to shift them around and change them. So there's lots of different theories about what it could be.
So if that system is destructive to other humanity, can it still be understood as truth?
So, okay, so another way of combating relativism, that everything is equal, is by saying we have to say that if something causes harm, whether physical or mental, then we have to say no, that isn't an okay practice. Right? But that becomes difficult because in the case of infanticide, we know that we're causing harm to the baby. And so we're weighing harm against the baby versus the community given this particular set of circumstances in their context. And so a lot of people say then we have to draw that line in terms of harm, right? So a lot of people say if we agree to relativism, then the Nazis can do whatever they want. That's their way of doing things. And then we do our way through things and we can't judge them. Right? But of course we have to, because they're causing harm. Right? So that might be one way of drawing some kind of line. But then we have difficulties in how we define what harm actually is, right? Where, how do we slide that? Right? Because what some people would consider harm, some people might not.
Is it okay that we have people in our American society who die because they are not providing medical care?
Right. Some
people say yes.
Right. And so this is the whole problem that we have in the allegory. If we have competing versions of what's true and what's real, how do we get along with each other? Because that's the situation we're in.
But that's not contained within the allegory itself, is it?
It isn't, right? So again, there's these different layers of reading, right? So there's the literal story, and then we want to think, what is it that Socrates is trying to tell us here? Right? So what could this possibly mean, and what kinds of questions does that then raise for us? And so as philosophers here in this context, it's really interesting to use allegory, and I'll be using parable later on in the week, which is different from allegory, but it also has this sense of being a metaphor, using symbol to explain different things in philosophy. What is Socrates trying to say, and where do these questions lead us? We can also ask, what is the cave? Is that somehow our original condition? Is that where we are right now? Is that where we're always going to be? But we think that there's something else other than that. I had a student once say, the cave was my neighborhood that I grew up in, right? And so we can think of the cave being various kinds of things. I also want to just mention, so there are various branches of philosophy, and I'll just describe them quickly. This isn't anything that you need to remember, obviously, but you might just be interested, because philosophy is often seen as being some kind of nebulous and ambiguous subject. You think of the Oracle of Delphi sitting at the top of this mountain doing his thing. But there are actually very specific branches of philosophy that are so diverse and wide-ranging. There are some that fall in the squarely in kind of the practical realm. So logic, computer scientists develop computer languages based on the principles of logic. And these principles of logic were established as early as in Aristotle's time, where he discovered the logical syllogism, right? A specific form of logical reasoning, deductive reasoning. We also have ethics, right? This is also a very practical kind of branch of philosophy. We can talk about applied ethics, business ethics, biomedical ethics, political philosophy also is within that realm. Then we can talk about theory, right? So we're starting to move more to the kind of where people think philosophy is in the clouds. And one of the things that you mentioned was this idea of harm. There's a philosopher who's at Berkeley right now named Peter Singer, whose work gave rise to PETA and the animal rights movement. And he's what we call a utilitarian. He says that we can define right action as that which produces the greatest happiness for the greatest number of people. Right? So that's one ethical theory for, that is in contrast with a lot of other competing theories. Then we have epistemology, which has to do with theories of knowledge. What can we know? How can we know it? And this text certainly approaches those kinds of questions. Metaphysics, what is the nature of reality? And within metaphysics, we have philosophy of religion. So we can ask questions about, can we prove the existence of God? What is the problem of evil? How do we know what is real from what is not real? These sorts of questions fall within metaphysics. And what's amazing about this allegory, and this is the reason why I wanted to use this one first, is because this allegory touches on all of those various branches of philosophy. So when we're thinking about epistemology, we can say that truth isn't always the thing that's most obvious or right in front of us. In this case, we can't simply collect more data about the shadows to learn about what the truth really is, right? This version of education isn't about acquisition of facts. More facts isn't going to help me. It rather requires that I actually shift, turn my body, and have a completely different perspective. So this is a description of education, not as learning stuff, right, or skills even, but is rather about attaining a whole new way of seeing stuff, right? A physical shift of body and perspective. In metaphysics, obviously, the difference between appearance and reality, it also touches on philosophy of religion, right? Is there some kind of transcendent higher reality that's different from the kind of reality that human beings experience just here in the physical world? Ethics, does the prisoner have a moral obligation to return to the cave and tell people what he saw? Or can he just simply live in peace outside with his new knowledge? How can we balance our own happiness with the needs of other people who haven't had the same experience? And then these political philosophy questions, right? How can we have a functioning society with these competing views and realities? So now let's come to the values of peace. Do you guys think that this is really a true description of what education is? Or do you think that's not true? Is it wrong?
Well, I'm trying to get a grip on this here, and I'm not sure I'm going to answer your question, but it's just something I'm thinking about. If almost every reform movement starts with a small group of people at the grassroots, I mean, the government's not going to do anything from up there and send it down to us. So a small group of people get together and they decide, this is wrong. Abolitionists started out as a small group of people, and they decided it was wrong. Now, if they had gone up to the light, and then you drag them back down in the cave, and then they would have announced to the people in the cave that it's wrong to own slaves, well, obviously they would have been cast out. Almost every reform movement seems to have a good end to it. The environmental movement started with the grassroots. Rachel Carson, she writes a book about Silent Spring. And nobody else was thinking that way. Well, there were some people thinking that way, but not too many. And so she starts this environmental movement, and I think everybody here would agree that that was a good thing. Now, I can't think of any negative. Maybe it's because it's politically incorrect for me to think of any negative, or because I couldn't tell you if I did think of any negative, because then maybe you'd cast me out. So I'm trying to get a grip on this here.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because when I think of this, I think of, like, for example, the civil rights movement or suffrage or some things that are kind of close within our history.
Yeah.
And I think the people who were on the fringes of that at the very beginning suffered quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have been given their legacy, so now we're like, well, obviously that was a no-brainer, but they've already won us over. But it's the winning over process, right, that's so painful. That does require, in a lot of times, when the stakes are high, and they go back down the cave
and they tell people what they've seen, and incredible courage to do that.
Yes, right. And so this is the courage to come out of the cave, right? I think is required, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even being dragged out, I think requires some kind of courage because a lot of people would say, "I'm very comfortable here with the shadows. Don't bother me."
Yeah.
Right, but then it also requires a different kind of courage to be able to return to the humiliation and the possible threat of death. And so sometimes my students say, hey, ignorance is bliss. I just don't want to be bothered by it because I know that it will involve a huge cost.
Mm-hmm. So your question was, is this education? Was that your question?
Yes.
Yes, this is education. That's my answer.
Okay.
Yeah. I guess I'm thinking about two things, the invisible hand and then the shadows, the bridge, the objects being going over the bridge, and the dragging out. I'm wondering if it's not an internal force of the person, if maybe the shackles that they're experiencing aren't physical so much as mental, and you know, who here hasn't pushed themselves to their limits in terms of their workload or their class load or exercise, like, hasn't pushed themselves to their breaking point, and why do we do that, you know?
And
so the idea of pain and being dragged and irritated and upset and unable to deal with it and cope, I mean, we've all done that at some point in our lives, and so this invisible hand, I don't know if it's like the will that we all have within us at some point. That's what I'm thinking, instead of like somebody dragging you up a steep staircase. And then I can't help but wonder, the bridge with the shadows going over it, if that isn't the enlightened people who've come back down, who feel morally obligated to share their experiences, and because they know that they can't reach the people who are still shackled by going down and speaking to them, because that's not going to get them very far very quickly. If maybe if you can just show them the real objects by taking them over the bridge, so they get some sense of what might exist, so at some point they could free themselves. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Am I talking any sense here?
Yeah, so
okay.
Kind of a small step is like,
right.
They can't handle the whole truth, but we'll give them these little shadows for a
while. Yeah, and so at some point maybe they can face it and turn around.
Yeah. So it's interesting because I'd want to think about, is that a good thing, right? Somebody who's seen something, right, that needs to be shared, or that they feel needs to be shared, and say, I'll give you the second rate version of it because I don't think you can handle the truth, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then so wonder what kind of danger is implicit in that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because we know that the prisoners will be eager to grab that and give names to it and say that that's the reality and be unwilling to give it up. But what you said before that was saying somehow there is something in us that propels us to be willing to give it up, even if we know that it involves some kind of sacrifice or suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And he clearly says on the second page, right, that once they're out in the light, won't they be glad that they took that journey? Won't they ultimately be glad, even though they were blinded and suffered all of that? Won't that be better than how they first were found? And so there might be a sense in the prisoner, like, yeah, I know, but I don't want to do that. But again, this is really interesting because this really contrasts the Western view versus the Eastern view, because the Eastern view doesn't see that suffering element as being somehow positive or necessary for the attaining of the wisdom itself.
Isn't this overly dramatic, though? I mean, because isn't the movement toward truth also seeing a little clearer, putting on glasses, or coming closer to the light and moving slowly. I think
Socrates is trying to describe it specifically as a dramatic process. That it's not a gradual kind of thing, right? A trickling in of facts or knowledge, because those won't help the prisoner at all, right? That it has to be this kind of shattering of the chains and this turning their body all the way around, the blinding and the, right, the kind of the dramatic.
Pretty stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Why do you say that?
Well, I mean, it's, this is, if somebody's laying out this thing about truth, and there's this subtle, I've got the real stuff, and it's sure not what you poor slobs have.
Yes.
You know, and,
yeah.
And I would have to say, certainly in my life, the movement toward truth is much more a gradual, steady, searching, struggling, and you know, it isn't like, oh, this is awful. I mean, there are a couple places in life where some of it is you know, more dramatic.
Yeah.
Most of it is not.
It made me think, I'm reading Josh Shank's newest book on Lincoln right now, and it kind of made me think of when, especially when Jericho was talking about his first experience going to the South and living on a plantation with a friend and living with slaves for the first time, and then taking a boat home and seeing the conditions of them being taken away from their families and living on a boat and being traded regardless of their children or their spouses. And like the way that Lincoln described that as being one of those dragged out of your shackle moments towards the sun, it reminded me a great deal of that, because it was like, for whatever reason, he sensed a differing truth with a capital T, that he recognized that he could no longer go back down into the cave.
Yeah.
For the same reason, you know. So.
Imagine how immigrants must feel when they move to another country. Doesn't matter what culture they move to. They move from their home to another culture.
From their cave.
Yeah, they come out of the cave. And they see that light of that culture and are terrified, perhaps terrified by it. Or maybe really enlightened by it, I guess, depends.
Maybe they were in the light and they moved into the cave.
Maybe.
Well, I think there are multiple caves. Yeah. One cave is another cave.
Yeah, and that's an interesting question. Does anyone ever get out of the cave? Is it possible that we'll be out of one? Does the symbol really work? Are we just creating caves for caves?
I was first, when we were first talking about it, I guess, I was thinking about, I was struggling with the idea of sort of taking one individual and like taking them to the truth. And then it kind of made sense with sort of people that were sort of, like Martin Luther King Jr. or someone that's kind of sees the truth with capital T and then kind of brings other people up. But just, I struggle with the idea of like an education being sort of an individual thing.
Yeah.
I feel like I like the idea of people sort of, and I feel like it's beneficial to, you learn so much in the community or with others. I don't know, I personally, you know, like, I learn more and get more out of things when I'm with other people. And when I can, like, talk about things, that's when I'm really processing, and, like, right now.
That without people, that wouldn't be possible, right? Because we just imagine this invisible hand, right, taking out, and there's no kind of discussion between the two. I'm doing this for your own good. I don't want to come. Or anything like that, right? Even that would be helpful, but it's just this process. And one of the things that Kierkegaard says about Socrates is that Socrates is the first thinker who really focuses on the single individual and about autonomy, and then therefore moral responsibility as a result of our autonomy. That before that it was the community, but that Socrates is really focusing on who is the person, what is the person, right? So the famous line from Socrates is, the unexamined life is not worth living, right? And so this is a very individual kind of process, right? We can examine our lives together, but it's really the person that has to examine their own life, discover their own telos, their ultimate aim and purpose, right? And that there's something solitary by nature about that process.
If there is that God who is doing the hand thing.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Is, I think you'd have to consider that the hand is drawing many people, and you see it during eras, during time periods. So I don't know. I think we can overemphasize the individual. And what happens is a lot of individuals begin to understand how other people are in the same place.
Right. And there is something about this that is religious, because he is talking about some kind of transcendence. Okay. Socrates lived before Jesus, and a lot of ancient philosophers, in particular Aristotle, were used by medieval philosophers as reading Christianity into the classical philosophers. So a lot of people were saying that Aristotle was just kind of paving the way for Christ or Catholic theology.
And a religious emphasis on the hand of God.
And Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And then the parable of the sower, and how some people stay with it, and some are on the rocky path. And, you know, some of them won't accept it.
But you still have to struggle with. What is that? Yeah. If Jesus is the way, truth, and life, what is that? I mean, because then he doesn't go on in paragraph two, says, you know, this is this, you know.
Yes. And that we're also all in community.
It's all a journey.
All of us, right? All of our little seeds are all living in some kind of community in the same place. Yeah. I'm glad that you mentioned parables, because we're done with our time, but the next one tomorrow is on Dostoevsky's Grand Inquisitor, which is another allegory, but it borders on parable. And then on Wednesday and Thursday, we're going to be talking about parables in Kierkegaard and in Kafka. So we'll be looking at parables are like allegories, but they have kind of a moral to them, right? Because they're telling us something. This allegory is used as a similar extended metaphor to get us to think about what is Socrates trying to say, or raise the kind of questions that we've been asking. But a parable actually has something it wants to tell us, and so we have to figure out what it's trying to tell us. And of course, the parables in the Bible, right, are a clear example of trying to tell us something or teach us some kind of a lesson. So thank you for coming.
You're
great. Right.